I was thinking before I came here, well, who do I want to dedicate this talk to? I mean, there's lots of people I could single out from this amazing Sangha. But the person I want to dedicate this talk to is someone who I've never met, who lives in another country to me, who I probably never will meet, actually, apart from through the letters I write to him. This man is called Cesare M. Moore, and he's in prison in America. And about a year and a half ago, he wrote a letter to the Ladies of the Wild Cherry, a restaurant that used to exist next door at the Larder. I used to work in it. And he wrote the letter based on an advert in a Dharma Life that was 14 years out of date. This was a magazine that we used to have in Tri Ratna, a very good magazine actually. And he basically wanted to expand his circle of friends, was what he said. And when I received this letter, because someone in the larder knew that I used to work in Wild Cherry, it's a bit of all these different conditions coming together, I read the letter and I thought, I just want to respond to this person and write to him. So we've been writing for the last year and a half. And recently he said to me that, in the letter, that, you know, prison walls cannot stop friendship. And I felt quite moved by that. But I also thought that without my own practice of friendship in this particular context, this particular Sangha and in Tri Ratna, I would probably not have responded to him in the way that I have, and all those different conditions would not have come together. So I feel I want to dedicate the talk to him, really, because he's taught me also something about friendship. So, Sangha, community. Well, traditionally, of course, this refers to all the enlightened women and men who've gone before us, the Arya Sangha, so who we draw our inspiration from. But also it's the community of practitioners we share our lives with, our Dharma lives with, and that's us, these people we're in this shrine room with, and those of them that aren't here today. So one, you could say functional, though that's not a very good word, is for the LBC is to support the development of that and to create community and Sangha. And the Buddha, you could say, radiated community into being by rediscovering the Dharma and deciding to teach. The Buddha had a vision of human beings as lotuses, which these hangings kind of depicts. He saw the potential that everyone had to grow, to blossom, to move towards the truth. And he also decided to, well, he also radiated that community into being by answering the call, really, responding to the request of Brahma Sahampati to teach. And Subhuti's talked about how Bhante also radiated community into being. And we here now are still benefiting from that. And I suppose the question is, how can we keep doing that? How can we keep on doing that? So what I'm going to say is, in a way, an offering. It's partial, it's my experience, and that will be different to your experience. It's Sangha, not really so much as an abstract ideal, but a kind of living expression. My experience of Sangha continues to unfold. In a way, one image for the Sangha is, well, it's an ever-widening circle. It's always expanding until eventually there'd be no shape at all. So, you know, my circle has expanded and hopefully it'll keep on expanding. Sangha's also been likened to a perfume, a fragrance that pervades the air, and a little bit of it can go a long way. As I've explained with, you know, Cesare, this guy I've been writing to. So Sangha is a living context, but it has to be on the basis of the Dharma, on the basis of the Buddha's teaching. And I've been listening to some talks by Visantra in the last few days that my friend Shraddha Sara, another Shraddha sister, recommended to me at my chapter the other night. I'd felt really resistant to going to my chapter because I'd had a long day. And then she came and talked about these talks, and so I ended up listening to a few of them. And one of the things that Visantra was talking about really tied in with some of the things that I want to say, really. So he was saying that the Buddha's teaching points out really our existential situation, and that we're living in danger on one bank of a river. And the Dharma is like our raft. The methods, the practices we have are the raft that we can use to get to the other shore, to navigate to safety, to freedom. The Buddha's teaching points us to reality, the reality of impermanence, insubstantiality, and unsatisfactoriness. We often don't recognise that we aren't safe, but maybe in the last few months we've seen this a bit more clearly. World events, our supposed safety and freedom, the relative peace that we live in and under is a bit more fragile. We've probably all been noticing that. But if we truly look, we can always see it's fragile. We're all in the same boat. We're all suffering, or if we're not now, at some point we will. Old age, sickness, death. We construct worlds around ourselves, me, me, me. One day we'll be separated from all we love. We don't get what we want, we get what we don't want. And at the same time, we have a longing for freedom, a heart wish to understand life as it is. And we also have a sense of our deeper connection with everyone and everything. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be here doing what we're doing, practicing the metta bhavana. So this journey image is quite good because I suppose I wanted to, in a way, talk about Sangha in terms of, well, some lessons we can learn from migrating geese. So this talk is called Lessons from Geese. So I'm going to read out the fact and the lesson first, then I'm going to talk about it, and there are five. So fact one. So each goose, when they're migrating, flaps its wings and creates an uplift for the other birds that follow. And by flying in a V formation, the whole flock adds 71% more range than if each bird flew alone. The lesson: people who share a common direction and sense of community can get where they are going quicker and easier because they are travelling on the trust of one another. So I often look at geese because I live near the canal and there's quite a lot of them. I hear them calling, I watch them flying in a V formation, I watch one standing protecting the others while they eat. It's like they definitely stick together, and there's something very beautiful about the call of wild geese when they're flying, that sense of freedom, something that's totally unowned and not ours. And this V formation, well, it's a point, isn't it, with a broad base. No, the goose, the lead goose, is just one of many, many geese. It's made up of the other geese, this V. And this points to the fact that we can do so much more together. Geese migrating, any birds migrating, it's a difficult and perilous journey. And our journey, our own journey, isn't literally going from a place called samsara to a place called nirvana. It's more of an existential inner journey. But on our journey, Sangha is our context, providing both the companionship of other geese, like a flock, and the exemplars who've gone before us, who've crossed over to safety, to freedom. So for each of us, those exemplars, those sources of inspiration will be different. For some people, it will be the Buddha. For someone else, it may be the life of Milarepa. Or it might be Yeshe Shogyal, one of Padmasambhava's female disciples. Or Bahir of the bark garment, who appears in the Pali Canon. I haven't got time to tell you their stories, but I'd really encourage you to read stories of, from the Arya Sangha, you know, people who have actually crossed over, journeyed, and found freedom. So it's really important that we have this kind of flock, this help, if you like. I'm going to read a poem by Rumi, which kind of says this in a slightly different way. The poem's called On Being Woven. So I'm going to change the word road to journey. This journey demands courage and stamina, yet it's full of footprints. Who are these companions? They are rungs in your ladder. Use them. With company, you quicken your ascent. You may be happy enough going along, but with others, you'll get farther and faster. Someone who goes cheerfully by himself or herself to the customs house to pay his traveller's tax will go even more light-heartedly when friends are with him. A wall standing alone is useless, but put three or four walls together and they'll support a roof and keep the grain dry and safe. Rushes and reeds must be woven to be useful as a mat. If they weren't interlaced, the wind would blow them away. So something about being woven, forming a flock, and working together that inspires me. Lone sailors, lone flyers, they may be happy enough going along in some ways, but they're also vulnerable, aren't they? We all need help, we all need support. We all need encouragement to stay on course, to keep going when the going gets tough, when the journey gets challenging. The flock, the Sangha, is about participating in and contributing, you could say, to something that's more than just us. So Sangha involves thinking globally, but also acting locally. It's like with the Metta Bhavana, you can think globally and hopefully, you know, try and let Metta pervade as far and wide as you can. But then we also have to think about how we're actually acting in the world, in our own sphere of influence. Can we act there with Metta? Can we act there with kindness? Can you build community and Sangha in your own heart? So the symbol of the order is, which I'm part of, is Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And he has 1,000 arms and one body. And there's a sense of that. These arms, these 1,000 arms, 1,000 hands. And each arm and hand carries something different, has something different. You could say our names as order members also give a sense of the different qualities that we can bring into the world. And, you know, that continues. More and more people join the order, more and more people are given a name which embodies something of practice for them, our own unique gifts and talents. And sometimes when I've been on order conventions and I've had this sense of collective practice, I have had some sort of sense of this symbol of Avalokiteshvara, these 1,000 arms. So we need the other geese because we need the momentum, the uplift. And this V formation serves the whole flock. And if we really look at the other geese around us, reflect on what we've been given, we can start to feel gratitude, which can lead to a serving of what we love. And in doing that, we forget about ourselves. Our sense of self starts to dissolve. Our preoccupation with me, self, the ego project, whatever you want to call it. So there's something about serving which can lead to self-forgetting and softening. And the Zen master Dogen talks about a way of expressing gratitude as being continuous practice. So Sangha gives us an opportunity to continually practice. So Sangha is support, really. It's partly what Sangha gives us. It gives us support. And we're fortunate, really fortunate, at the LBC to have such a large and ever-increasing Sangha, or flock of geese. So many different geese, shapes, sizes, ages, so much diversity and richness to learn from. And it's so easy to take that for granted. I know yesterday Vandana Jyoti, who I share a house with, was doing a day in Leicester for 8 people. It's a very small little sangha. It's a fledging sangha, you could say. It's like a fledgling. But she went there and is encouraging that to grow. But here at the LBC, we have so many opportunities to fly together, to be on teams together. Winter retreats, summer retreats, spring retreats, class teams, working together, living together, studying together, meeting together. So we've got a lot of opportunities to act together, to actually, you could say, to actually be of benefit, actually act beneficially for everyone and the whole world. So ultimately, of course, we have to fly ourselves. No one can do it for us. No one can practice for us. It's only us that can actually work on our minds. It's only us that can create community in our own minds and hearts. But we can do this with others. We don't have to do it by ourselves. And our Sangha isn't perfect. It isn't the Arya Sangha. It's not a community of enlightened women and men. But there are opportunities to develop friendship which lasts and is able to withstand challenges, separation, and involve a genuine love and care for each other over many years. And I guess in my own experience I've really seen that because I have been involved in this centre for almost 30 years, which is most, well, quite a lot of my life. I was on my first retreat with Sugati, who's lying over there in the corner, and we've been friends for a long time. It's like we've grown up together. So I have, you know, so many long-standing friendships, and I feel immensely grateful for that. So Sangha as support. So second fact from the geese. When a goose falls out of formation, it suddenly feels the drag and resistance of flying alone. It quickly moves back into formation to take advantage of the lifting power of the bird immediately in front of it. Lesson. If we have as much sense as a goose, we stay in formation with those headed where we want to go. We're willing to accept their help and give our help to others. Well, sometimes we like to think we can fly alone, don't we? Do it all ourselves. And our society emphasises that again and again. The individual, being independent, free thinking, blah, blah, blah. And I've worked in lots of situations in teams, and I often think, if only I could do this on my own, it'd be much easier. I wouldn't have to negotiate. I wouldn't have to take in this person or that person. I could just do it myself, and it'd be really successful. But of course, that's not true. I know that on some level, and yet there's a part of me that still thinks that, still wants to operate myself in my way. But it is very hard, as I've already said, to practice alone. We need the warmth of the Sangha. It's like our potential, our human potential to grow, needs a hot house. and the hothouse is the Sangha. We can't really develop metta alone. We need other people. We need people for each stage, don't we, including the fourth stage? How else will we actually begin to break down those boundaries that we set up between us and the world, even within the Sangha? It's so easy to do. So really, one thing we could think about in terms of Sangha is we're on this journey of discovery. We're trying to share our understanding. We're trying to help each other see through our stories, help each other learn to let go. And an image came to me of this thing of going it alone. It's like this closed fist, whereas the Sangha is more like an open hand. There's an opportunity to both give, which the hand can do, and receive, which the hand can do. And even with this open hand of Sangha, life, as Sangharakshita says, will still slip through our fingers like snow. There will still be constant change. There'll be flowing, unfolding. Things won't stay the same. But if that hand, if this hand has an eye in it, an eye that can see clearly, a Dharma eye, an eye that tries to see the truth, like in the beautiful hands of White Tara, the Bodhisattva who I meditate on, then there's a chance at least that we could see more clearly. We could give what's really needed. We could respond from a basis of Dharma, a seeing that really sees there's nothing or no one to defend or protect. And one of the meanings of Tara is to ferry across. So she seems quite an important figure to me as I'm talking about migrating geese and journeys and us moving across the sky. But at the same time, again from Vasantra, listening to his talk, he was saying that he had been talking to Sangharakshita, and Vasantra's fairly recently, been on a 3-year retreat. And Bhante was saying that really people don't realise how deep our poisons, kleshas, veils run. So things like greed, hatred, delusion. This sense of self, other, subject, object. The veils do get finer, they get more transparent, but I guess being in the Sangha gives us an opportunity to really see where those veils are, where they do get finer, where they do become more transparent. And it also shows us where the veils become more like curtains and are much heavier. So Sangha is a practice, not just a support. Others are the occasion, you could say, not the cause of our reactions. And we can learn from the examples of others. We can accept help and be receptive. And I'm going to read a poem which I'd like to dedicate to Dharmadina, my preceptor, who I think embodies something of this. It's called Elegance by Hafiz, and I feel I've learnt a lot from her. It is not easy to stop thinking ill of others. Usually one must enter into a friendship with a person who has accomplished that great feat herself. Then something might start to rub off on you of that true elegance. So, fact 3. When the lead goose tires, it rotates back into the formation and another goose flies to the point position. Lesson. It pays to take turns doing the hard tasks and sharing leadership. As with geese, people are interdependent on each other's skills, capabilities, and unique arrangement of gifts, talents, and resources. So, I was thinking about our Sangha, and I was thinking, well, you know, we've definitely got a chairman. We've got Yarnavalcha, which is great. But the centre doesn't grind to a halt if Yarnavalcha's away. He's been on a three-week solitary recently, and it's still carried on. So it isn't that it's just Yarnavalcha doing everything. He couldn't do everything. He has a council of people who help him. There are teams for classes. There's a team for today, isn't there? Jayaka and Shraddhasiddhi have been taking in turns to lead. It's important that we have like different people leading things. Doesn't mean we don't have leaders. We've all got different skills and capabilities. But again, it comes back to this thing of realising that we can't do it alone and we can't always be the leader. We're not invincible. The point of the V in terms of the goose formation is only as strong as the rest of the V. We don't need to be a superhero goose, but we do need to see interconnectedness and see ourselves as part of a community. So, generosity with self is a way of contributing to Sangha, and it's a movement from the inside out. But then by giving, by being generous, we create a quality or an attitude of generosity, and that then has effect from the outside in. So I guess we can be the qualities that we long to bring into being. If you want friends, try and be a friend. If you want appreciation, try and be appreciation. If you want love, be love. If you want kindness, be kind. Another poem. I like poems. They seem to communicate quite a lot to me. So this is by Hafiz, and it's Admit Something. Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, love me. Of course, you do not do this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this. This great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye, that is always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in this world is dying to hear. If we can try and dwell in the energy of qualities we want to bring about, then that energy can flow from the heart, irrespective of the circumstances we find ourselves in. Can flow from the inside out. We create our own world by what we bring about in our hearts and mind, and then that can get reflected back. And we also need to just really accept help. We receive a lot of help. If we think about this Buddhist centre, this shrine room, we rest on the shoulders of those who've gone before us. There's a lineage. Sometimes when I meditate in this shrine room, I feel like all the practice that people have done here, there's like an atmosphere, it's palpable. Think of all the metta that people have experienced here, the mindfulness, the awareness. And, you know, yeah, just really try and experience that. It's enabled something for us. I was recently watching an old black and white film of the guys building the LBC. And I was watching it when I was visiting some friends, Vimalachitta and Nagabodhi. And it was a kind of silent movie. It was an old black and white movie. So there were no interviews, no talking about the difficulties, the challenges, what they'd done. But somehow watching them, working together, seeing them, and also knowing that some of them are dead now, some of them, you know, just aren't part of the Sangha anymore. I just found that very moving. There was something about the fact that I just saw these people using their energy, working together without the words, that moved me. So I guess I'm a bit of a team player. I often get inspired by watching teams Like sometimes the relay races in the Olympics, in a way, I find more moving than the individual races. There's something about people in a team. It's like you've got to hand on this baton. Someone might drop it. They might mistime their run. But when the changes are seamless, when they're not clunky, there's a smooth flow, like a dance. It's like the individual qualities can still shine, but there's no strain or sense of holding on to being the one. There's like this giving and receiving, the baton is handed on. And then it doesn't matter who leads, who does which bit of the relay. When we forget the self as a reference point, and sometimes we do, don't we? Sometimes we do forget the self. There's just this sense of flow and dance between us, which is very beautiful. Okay, fact four. The geese flying in formation honk to encourage those up front to keep up with their speed. Lesson. We need to make sure our honking is encouraging. In groups where there is encouragement, growth is much greater. Individual empowerment and group empowerment results from quality honking. So I was thinking of, again, of my own experience, and I do feel like I've been on the receiving end of a lot of encouraging honking in my life, and I feel very grateful for that. I have never felt that anyone's tried to stop me from doing anything in the Sangha. And that I've had a lot of encouragement. So I guess I really wanted to ask the questions, well, what's our honking like? Are we aware? Do we notice, observe others? Do we see them with kind eyes? Do we rejoice in them? Think about how people light up and grow through kindly speech. It's like a flower opening, isn't it? So do we see people with kind eyes? What are our thoughts like? Are they kind? What about our speech? Is it kind? And then our actions, are they kind? Kind comes from kin, which means tribe or family. So we can take responsibility through our thoughts, our views, how we talk to ourselves, how we look at ourselves, and that will affect also how we look and talk to others. And we probably all know from our experience that what we focus on grows. So if we focus on gratitude, what we've received, that will grow. That will start to amplify our experience of positive qualities. So honking can be gratitude, appreciation, knowing what you've received. And this is often very alive in us when we first get involved, I think, in Sangha. We really realise what we've received. But then it's easy to forget. So we need to keep on reminding ourselves so that we don't take what we have for granted. So I mentioned earlier that I live with Vandana Jyoti, and I think Vandana Jyoti is very good at doing good, encouraging, quality honking. And I feel very fortunate to live with her. And I say that partly because Vandana Jyoti and I didn't really know each other that well before we lived together. We've grown to know each other more and to try and encourage each other. And we also, you know, confess things to each other. We admit our shortcomings. She has a saying that, well, she talks about herself, but I would include myself in it, that we can be like mollusks as well, where we don't want to change and we get very caught in our own things. But I just want to, rejoice in her quality honking. So I also want to say that the Buddha was a grateful Buddha, and that gratitude's a really important quality. The Buddha was grateful to the tree that sheltered him, and he also reverenced the Dharma and chose then, by answering this call that I mentioned earlier from Brahma Sahampati, not on his mobile phone, of course, but he answered it, he reverenced the Dharma through deciding to teach. And also Ananda, at the end of the Buddha's life, said, not he who is so wise, but he talked about he who was so kind. And the Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. Something I often reflect on, or this verse comes to mind sometimes, I think it's a Tibetan verse, maybe even from a meditation practice. All beings suffer continuously in the six realms, yet desire only happiness and peace. Never forgetting this, may I always act with kindness unto others. Now, I often fail in that, but it reminds me that, yeah, all beings suffer continuously, and it does remind me to try and act from that. So even our constructive feedback can be kind, the constructive feedback we give to each other, maybe when we feel let down, when something happens, and our timing's important in that. But also any constructive feedback we receive, we could just try and see it as information. It's very easy to look at people with critical eyes, to focus on what people aren't doing. It's easy to moan, complain. But there's a great Tibetan proverb that I really like that makes me laugh and often I bring to mind if I find myself getting into moaning and complaining, and it's like this. Don't notice the flea in the other person's hair, and overlook the lumbering yak on your own nose. So honking, encouraging honking, quality honking, is exemplification. It's a kind of walking the talk. It creates an atmosphere. It's something that is caught, not taught. But we do communicate the Dharma, our Dharma practice, by the way we are with each other. I work currently at Lama's Pajamas, and recently a customer, I think he's probably a plumber or a builder, something like that, who's been coming into the shop for a while, said, the way you are, the way you all are, I want something of that. So I thought, oh yeah, something has got communicated. We haven't talked to him about that we're Buddhists, we haven't talked to him about meditation, but something in the way we've tried to run the shop, in a helpful way, in a friendly way, in an honest way, in a respectful way, in a kind way, has had an effect. So it's provided a kind of opening for that person. But we also need to notice our reactions. Subhuti calls our reactions the boreholes to self-clinging. And it is good to see our reactions and see what it is we react to. And it's quite important to reflect on everything that happens to us, reflect on why we reacted, and to see our life as a kind of teacher. And by doing that, the same old thoughts and reactions gradually can get used up. Ultimately, though, I think we need a bigger perspective in which to see each other. And the poet Rilke has a verse that I really respond to, and he says, once the realization is accepted that even between the closest human beings, infinite distances continue to exist, a wonderful living side by side can grow up. If they succeed in loving the distance between them, which makes it possible for each to see the other whole against the sky. So this is the sky of shunyata, or emptiness. Empty in a sense that there's nothing in us to hold on to. And sometimes we get glimpses of this. We see this vastness in each other. We see each of us whole against the sky. It might be in nature, just seeing someone against a huge redwood tree or an oak tree, or just having a sense of ourselves on retreat, standing in a vast starry sky or underneath a vast starry sky. It's like real quality honking can come from that. So, fact five. When a goose gets sick, wounded, or shot down, two geese drop out of formation and follow it down to help and protect it. They stay with it until it dies or is able to fly again. Then they launch out with another formation or catch up with the flock. If we have as much sense as geese, we will stand by each other in difficult times as well as when we are strong. So in order to really do this, we have to have enough time and space to respond. So we have to think a little bit about what we do. Don't make our lives so busy that we don't have the space to respond, the time to respond. 10 years ago, I was seriously ill. I was diagnosed with cancer and I had surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy. My 19 years of Dharma practice within this Sangha had given me lots of tools to meet this impermanence that I was suddenly really confronted with, the dukkha and the insubstantiality. I had reflected on the Dharma a lot. I had reflected on the four reminders, the preciousness of human birth, the fact that it was precarious. I thought about my parents' death, I'd thought about lots of people's death, but I hadn't quite expected my own mortality to be there in my very early 40s. But that was the case. I suppose what that highlighted for me was the importance of practicing when you're healthy. And also it highlighted to me my experience of Sangha. I felt surrounded by love. In fact, I felt bathed in love. And not just from my individual friends. There was so much care and well-wishing. Every day, cards came through my letterbox. People I didn't know sending me metta, sending me love. So much well-wishing. People sent me money, a friend paid for me to have acupuncture. My friends were very there for me and I felt loved and that love sustained me and it made a difference. I remember the women at Tirat Naloka meditated while I had surgery. They really wanted to know what time I was having surgery. Some friends later told me they chanted white Tara mantras for me, which are supposed to be about long life, merit and wisdom. Maybe they worked. I'm still here 10 years later. And two women in the Sangha that I knew had had similar experiences and they were willing to share what they'd learnt. And they exemplified something for me in how they each dealt with their own challenge of cancer. The why me that sometimes appeared didn't really stay for that long because of my practice of Dharma within this Sangha. I felt like that quickly changed to why not me? Why not me who has a human body, who is subject to old age, sickness and death like everybody else? That experience definitely meant that some of the identity that I had to let go of. My image for it is it was like I fell off a train I'd been on for years, and I fell into a bit of an unfamiliar landscape. In some ways, it was like being on an urban retreat for a year. Sometimes people said, oh, are you doing lots of study? I said, no. I'm just trying to be with the experience I'm having. I've done quite a lot of study. I can now use that to reflect on. Some of my views, as I said, ideas I had of myself softened. My boundaries felt looser. I remember once walking to the hospital from St. Paul, going for one of my treatments. And I thought about all the times I'd been to St. Paul's over the years and how I'd only noticed all the healthy people rushing to work in their smart suits or going into the shops or doing whatever they were doing. But then, looking a bit closer that day as I got off the tube, I suppose I really saw all the sick people in amongst those healthy people in their suits. They were maybe not so many of them, but I saw people with sticks, people who had lost their hair like I had. And I glimpsed and saw how this is the case for everyone. And of course, during that time I was ill, I had to withdraw inwards to conserve my energy. But I tried not to withdraw inwards in terms of people. I tried to always carry people within my heart. And the Sangha made a huge difference to me, and I know, and I knew, and I still know now, that I would not be here now, be who I am without the Sangha. And that's not the LBC Sangha just in its present manifestation, but all those who have been part of it, and for me still are part of it. This shrine room has walls, but in a way it doesn't have walls. The walls spread all over the world. Probably people who've meditated here in this room have gone to all sorts of different places. So yeah, I feel that the Sangha, in a way, really was crucial for me. And the Sangha also reflected me back. I remember once having a conversation with my Trayabandhu. I'd gone to the park and I'd been looking at the magnolia tree. And I said to him, I feel like I've been seeing the magnolia-ness of the magnolia. And I said, you must go and see this tree, my Trayabandhu, you must go and see it. And he said, I have seen it, but I'm not seeing it as you're seeing it. And something about that, he just mirrored something back to me. And again, that for me was an example of real friendship, actually, his perceptions and just mirroring something back. So again, I feel grateful. So, the geese have given us some lessons. They've given us the lessons of flying together, honking encouragingly. They've given us lessons about creating sangha. And I guess what I hope is that this image of the geese travelling together might touch your imagination. It might be something you bring to mind in terms of your own friends. That something about the way these geese are trying to operate might in some way communicate something to you about how to learn to relate to friends. Bhante, at the end of What is the Sangha, talks about friendship and Sangha as a training in unselfishness. And he says that learning to relate to our friends by sharing, being open, being honest, trying to operate from love, trying to learn to relate in terms of metta, all of that starts to dissolve the boundaries between us and our friend. And through that, we gradually learn to respond to the world in that way. And this gives us some sort of sense of why, at some point in his life, the Buddha said that friendship, sangha, if you like, community, is the whole of the spiritual life. You can see why from that comment about we gradually learn to just respond to the world in this way, why that comment is it makes sense, why Sangha is so important. So we gradually learn to respond to the world in the same way that we respond to our friends. And then, like the geese, we fly free in the sky. And I'm just going to end with a little section from a poem which has the geese flying freely. So tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, and the mountains and rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.